breathe, smile. You are online. Brother Pháp Lưu, we are online or not? Có Pháp Lưu đây không? Có. Có. We are online. This Dhamma talk is a kind of Dhamma talk a la carte, requested by Parallax Press. Parallax wants Thầy to give a talk on the theme of fidelity, intimacy. And they have been waiting for this Dhamma talk. Good morning, dear Sangha. Today is December the 26th in the year 2010. We are in the Dharma Cloud Temple, Upper Hamlet, Plum Village, during our winter retreat. Last time, during the Dharma talk, we discussed about true home. Every one of us is trying to find our true home. And those of us who have found our true homes, others are still looking, searching, finding. And we also have said that our true home is inside. And with the energy of mindfulness, we can go back to our true home in the here and the now. And Sangha is our true home. It's funny that in Vietnamese, the husband called the wife my home, and the wife called the husband her home. Nhà tôi, it means my house, my home. And when the gentleman was asked, is asked where is his wife, he said, my home is now at the post office. And if the guy said that, well, your home is beautiful, who decorated that? It's my home who decorated that. It meant my husband. And when the husband called his wife, he said, Nhà ơi, my home. And she said, here I am. Nhà ơi, nhà tôi. So when you are in such a relationship, the other person is your home, your true home. And you should be a true home for him or for her. It's very clear. In a relationship, you should be your own true home in order for you to be his home or her home. That is the practice. Now in these days, still people still in Vietnam still call themselves my home as husband and wife. We understand that, but we should practice in order to be a true home for ourselves and a true home for the one that we love. And how? We need the practice. Thank you. in Plumlish, every time you hear the bell, you stop thinking. You stop talking. You stop doing things. You pay attention to your in-breath. You breathe in. And you say, I listen. I listen. This wonderful sound brings me back to my true home. My true home is inside. My true home is in the here and the now. So practicing to go home is what we do all day long. Because we are only comfortable in our true home. And our true home is available. The question is whether we want and we know how to go home. And we can go home every moment. And our home should be safe, intimate, cozy. And it is us who make our home cozy and safe. Last week, I had tea with a couple who came from the United Kingdom. They spent 2 weeks in Plumlish, in the Upper Hamlet. And the lady said, it's strange. It's the first time I live in a place where there are hundreds of men, no women, and I feel very safe in the Upper Hamlet. I have never feel safe like that. In the Upper Hamlet, there were only men. She was the only woman, and she felt very safe. And if she feels safe, the place is her home, because home should provide that kind of safety. Are you safe for him or for her? Do you have enough stability, strength, protection for the one you love? And the gentleman said that, well, the last 2 weeks may be the best weeks of my life. And that is because of the work of Sangha building. When you build a Sangha, you build a home for yourself. And in that that place, you feel at home, you feel at ease, you feel safe. If you don't feel safe within yourself, you are not home for your own self. And you cannot provide your beloved one a home. And that is why it's very important to go back to yourself and make it safe for you and for the ones you love. If you feel lonely, if you feel cut off, if you suffer, if you need healing, you cannot expect to heal and to be warm by having sexual relationship with another person. It cannot heal you. You will create more suffering for him, for her, and for yourself. In the third mindfulness training, we learn that sexual desire is not love. And without love, sexual activities can only bring suffering to you and to the other person. Loneliness cannot be dissipated by sexual activities. And you cannot heal yourself by having sex. You have to learn how to heal yourself. To be comfortable within. And you begin to have home. And as you have home, you have something to offer to the other person. And the other person has to do exactly the same thing. The other person has to heal himself, to heal herself. To get warm inside so that she will feel better, at ease. And she can become your home. She can share that with you. Otherwise, what she has to share is only her loneliness, her sickness, her suffering. That cannot help heal you at all. There are three kinds of intimacy. The first one is physical and sexual. The second is emotional intimacy. And the third one is spiritual. And sexual intimacy cannot be separated from emotional intimacy. This should go together. And if the spiritual intimacy is there, the physical, the sexual intimacy will have its sense. And it will be healthy and healing. Otherwise, it will be destructive. Every one of us is seeking emotional intimacy. We want to be in harmony. We want to have real communication. Mutual understanding, communion. And in the light of the Buddhist practice, you have to listen to your own suffering. There is suffering inside of you, and there is suffering inside of the other person. If you do not listen to your own suffering, you will not understand it. And you will not have compassion for yourself. And compassion is the element that helps heal yourself. So the first thing the Buddha talked about is the suffering inside. And most of us try to run away from our own suffering. Most of us try to cover up the suffering inside by means of consumption. We consume food, we consume music, consume many other things, and we consume sex. But that does not help. That only something we do in order to cover up the suffering inside. And that is why the Buddha proposed that we go home to us with courage, in order to recognize the suffering inside. and listen deeply to the suffering inside. If you know how to practice mindful breathing, you can improve the quality of your in-breath and out-breath. Your in-breath and out-breath will become more peaceful, deeper, slower. It will help your body to relax. It will help your feelings to be less intense, painful. And this is the practice recommended by the Buddha, so that you are capable of going home to yourself without fear. Because many of us are fearful. We don't want to go back to ourselves because we believe that going back to ourselves, we will encounter the block of suffering inside. We will be overwhelmed by the suffering inside. That is why we try always to run away from ourselves, from our suffering, looking for things to consume in order to forget. Sometimes we just eat in order to forget our suffering. Sometimes we drive, we talk over telephone. And the market provide us with many, many means in order to run away from ourselves. But the Buddha recommended that we use the energy of mindfulness generated by breathing, walking, and get some strength to go home in order to courageously recognize the suffering inside and embrace it tenderly. My suffering, I know you are there. I'm home and I'm taking care of you. And you listen deeply to the suffering inside. And that suffering may have been transmitted to you by your parents or your ancestors. That time when we suffer and we don't know why we suffer, we don't know the nature of that suffering. We want to cry. We don't understand. And if we want to understand, we have to go back and embrace and recognize it. Our ancestors, our parents, may have not been able to transform their suffering, and they have transmitted them to us. And now if we encounter the Buddha Dhamma, we have a chance. We can learn how to recognize it, embrace it, and transform it for us and for our ancestors, our parents. Out of love, dear ancestors, dear father, dear mother, I have received this block of suffering from you. I accept. I will try my best. I know the Dharma. I know the practice. I will learn to recognize this block of suffering that has been transmitted to me, and with love, I will try to accept and to transform it. And you can do it out of love. You do it for your parents, for your ancestors. And we practice not only for ourselves, but for our ancestors, because we are our ancestors. And according to the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, unless you listen to your suffering, unless you look deeply into your suffering, you embrace it tenderly with your energy of mindfulness, you cannot understand the roots of your suffering. And when you begin to understand the roots of your suffering, suddenly the energy of compassion, of understanding arises. Understanding one's own suffering always make the energy of compassion arise. And understanding and compassion have a power to heal. And by embracing and listening to your suffering, you bring about understanding and compassion. Understanding here is understanding suffering. Compassion is born from understanding. And when the nectar of compassion is born into you, you suffer less. You feel less lonely, less cold. You begin to feel the warmth within yourself, and you are building a home inside of yourself. The Buddha recommends us to build a home inside, an island within ourselves. Be an island unto yourself. Build an island within yourself. You feel comfortable, you feel warm, and you can be a refuge for the other person too. And when you have understood your own suffering, your own loneliness, you feel lighter, and you can very well listen to the suffering of the other person. It becomes easier now to understand his or her suffering, because you have understood your own suffering. Your suffering carries within itself the suffering of your ancestors, of the world. My suffering reflects the suffering of my society, interbeing. My suffering is in your suffering, and your suffering is in my suffering. That is why when I have understood my suffering, it becomes much easier for me to understand your suffering. Understanding is a kind of gift. When you understand someone's suffering, that is a great gift you can make to him or to her. The other person feels for the first time that she is understood. And understanding is love itself. Understanding is the other name of love. Because if you don't understand, you cannot love. This is very clear. If you don't understand your son, you can love your son. If you don't understand your father, you cannot love your father. So understanding is love. And to offer understanding means to offer love. And understanding another person is not possible without understanding self. And our ancestors have said, you have to understand yourself. Connect toa to man. And home building begin with yourself. And the other person will join you in building home within herself and himself. And after that you can call her your home. And she can call you her home. If in the Upper Hamlet we build a Sangha as our home, in a family, you build your family, members of your family, as members of a Sangha, because family is a kind of Sangha. Because Sangha means simply community. If your family only has two persons, that is the smallest Sangha. And then if you have a child, three members of the Sangha. And if you have four, you have a Sangha of four. And your family is your home. And building a family is like to build a Sangha. And the teaching of the Buddha is to help us to build a Sangha. Because a Sangha is a refuge for ourselves and for many people. And the most noble task is to build a Sangha. After enlightenment, the first thing the Buddha thought of is to go and seek and look for elements to build the Sangha. So we go home to ourselves. We listen to the suffering inside of us. We embrace our pain, our sorrow, our loneliness with the energy of mindfulness. And that kind of understanding, that kind of insight will help transform the suffering inside of us. We feel lighter, we begin to feel warm and peace inside. And that is for us. And that is for the other person as well. And then when the other person join you in building home, now you have an ally. You are helping him and he is helping you. And together you have home. You have home in yourself. You have home in him, in her also. If that kind of intimacy doesn't exist, has not existed, and then sexual relationship can cause a lot of damage. And that is why in the beginning, I said that physical, sexual intimacy cannot be separated from the emotional intimacy. And between the spiritual and the emotional, there is a link. Spiritual is not just a belief in a teaching, in a spiritual teaching. Spirituality is a practice, and the practice always bring relief, communion, communication, transformation. Everyone needs a spiritual dimension in his or her life. Without a spiritual dimension in our life, we cannot deal with the difficulties that we encounter in our daily life. You should have a practice, a spiritual practice, a Dharma life. And if we should have a path, a spiritual path. We learn the Dharma. We learn how to put into practice the Dharma. And with that kind of practice, we can deal with the difficulties we encounter in our daily life. With a spiritual path, with a spiritual practice, with the Dharma body, you are no longer afraid because you know that you can handle, you can confront, you can handle the difficulties presented to you in your daily life. You have a Dharma body in yourself. You have a physical body. You can do a lot of things with your physical body, but you also have a Dharma body, your spiritual life, your Dharma practice. And with that Dharma body, you are no longer afraid. You know that you can handle, you can overcome, you can get out of the difficult situation. The practice of breathing, walking, concentrating, understanding is very important. And your spiritual practice can help you a lot dealing with your emotion, helping you to listen, to embrace your own suffering, and helping you to recognize and embrace the suffering of the other person. That is why these two forms of spiritual these two forms of intimacy you know how to deal with a strong emotion like fear, anger, despair. And because you know how to do that, you can feel more peaceful, warmer within yourself. And the spiritual practice helps you build a home within yourself for your sake and for the sake of the other person. That is why emotional intimacy cannot be separated from spiritual intimacy. And the three kinds of intimacy is inter-are. In the third mindfulness training, we learn that sexual desire is not love. I have to remember that. Sexual activities without love is called empty sex. Empty sex. And that is something that is prevailing in our society. And that is causing a lot of suffering to our young people. So empty sex should be avoided. And if you are teachers, school teachers, if you are parents, you should help your children, your students to learn about that. Because the young people nowadays, they practice a lot empty sex. That is destroying their body, their mind, bringing a lot of damage to their mind and their body. And there are many kind of damages. Later on, there will be depression. There will be mental disorders. There will be suicide. And many of them do not know that these troubles, these disorders have to do with empty sex or sexual abuse. They don't see the connection between sex and these physical and mental disorders in them. Poor Buck wrote this novel, East Wind and West Wind, and she described it, a couple in China. About 100 years ago. The young lady and the young man both belong to big families, wealthy families. And the young man went to America to study and got a medical degree. He came home to China as a doctor, medical doctor. And she was, the young woman was educated in the traditional Chinese way. You are born and you are raised to become a mother, to become a wife, to become the servant of a man. You have to obey 100% the will, the desire of your man. That's the all Chinese, traditional Chinese culture. Man is a master and lord. And you have to learn how to cook to satisfy his need of eating. You have to learn how to satisfy all his needs. But the young man who became a doctor, he had learned the Western way. And he wanted his wife to be equal to him. The first night, in the eve of in the evening of the of day, they found themselves alone, and the first thing he did is to lift the veil and to look at her face. She was very scared. She did not know what to do. She had been instructed by her mother to be silent, not to be too warm. And she had a lot of fear. And he began to talk to her. That night, after the feasting and bantering, laughter had ended, I sat alone upon the couch in the bridal chamber. I was stiff with my fear. The hour I had imagined and dreaded and longed for all my life was come. The hour when, for the first time, my husband looked on my face and we were alone together. My cold hands were pressed against each other in my lap. Then he came in, still so tall and somber in those dark foreign clothes. He came to me at once, and in silence he lifted the veil from my face and looked long upon me. Thus he acknowledged me. Then he took one of my cold hands. The wisdom of my mother had taught me thus: be chill rather than warm, be the tongue of wine rather than the surfeiting sweetness of honey, then his desire will never fail. Therefore, I was reluctant to give him my hand. Instantly, he withdrew his own and gazed at me in silence. Then he began to speak with grave earnestness. At first I could not comprehend his words, for the marvel of his voice in my ears, a quiet deep man's voice that made my body flush with shyness. What was he saying? It is not to be supposed that you would be drawn to me whom you behold for the first time, as I behold you also. You have been forced into this marriage as much as I have. Because the marriage was arranged, had been arranged by families both sides. You have been forced into this marriage as much as I have. We have been helpless in this matter until now. Yet now that we are alone, we may create our life according to our own desire. For myself, I wish to follow the new ways, the Western way. I wish to regard you in all things as my equal. I shall never force you to anything. You are not my possession, my chattel. You might be my friend, if you will. That is what he said. These are the words I hear on my bridal night. At first, I was amazed beyond understanding of their meaning. I equal to him, but why? Was I not his wife? If he did not tell me what to do, then who would? Was he not my master by law? No one had forced me to marry him. What else could I do if I did not marry? And how could I marry except as my parents arranged it? I begin to twist my hands in my lap, not daring to speak, not knowing how to reply. He placed one of his hands over both of mine, and we were silent for a while. But I only wished that he would take his hand away. I felt his eyes on my face. At last he spoke, his voice low and bitter. It is as I fear. You will not, you cannot show me your real mind. You dare not break away from what you have been taught you should say and do at this time. Listen to me. I do not ask you to speak. But I beg of you this small token. If you are willing to try the new path with me, bend your head a little lower. He watched me closely. I could feel his hand pressing down steadily. What did he mean? Why could not things proceed in the expected way? I was ready to be his wife. I desired to be the mother of sons. Oh, then my sorrow began, this heaviness that never leaves me by day or night. I knew not what to do, and in my despair and ignorance, I bent my head. I am grateful, he said, rising to his feet and removing his hand. Rest quietly in this chamber. Remember, you have nothing to fear now or ever. Be at peace. I will sleep this night in the little chamber adjoining. He turned swiftly and went away. That's what happened during that night. I ran to the door, thinking in my wildness that I might escape and return to my mother's home. But my hand upon the heavy iron bar recalled me. For me, there could never be any return. Even though by miracle I escaped through the unknown courtyards of my new home, there was the strange street. Even though by miracle I found my way to the familiar gate, I could never be open to receive me anymore. So without understanding each other, the couple stayed like that for many months. And both tried to understand each other. And one day he tried to say that because they were living in a new home with an upper floor, and she was afraid of climbing up because her feet was bind according to the Chinese way, and it's very weak. And one day he used a pencil and he draw the inside of her feet that look very feeble, that look not healthy. And he said, "Your feet are not beautiful because they are not healthy." And she suffers so much because she have bonded her feet since childhood in order to be beautiful. And now he did not see it as beautiful. So a few months later, when she had a chance to go home to visit her mother, her mother saw her depressed, not happy at all. And she inquired, and she knew. And finally said, "Maybe you have to be your husband. Things have changed. If needed, you can unbind your feet." So she went through many anguishes before decided to unbind her feet, and he helped her. And they spent so many months in order to try to understand each other's culture and thinking and aspiration before understanding arise and love is born and become a very happy couple after. That is what happened in this novel. What we can see is that the man did not want to have any sexual relationship with her, with his wife, unless there is a mutual understanding and trust. Because he saw that there is no real happiness having sexual relationship if there is no mutual understanding, and that will create damage. That his insight. He was not a Buddhist practitioner, and she was not either. And yet, they were able to do that. One nun of the New Hamlet told Thay that there was a lady practitioner. Who is in love with a gentleman. She loves her a lot. And and feel that she needs him. But every time he has a sexual relation with her, that love is crushed, disappear for many months before she could begin to rebuild it again. Apparently, there is not enough mutual understanding. And the way he shared his body with her and she with him. Does not help building more understanding. Love, happiness. And that posed the question as whether true love is possible without sexual relationship. In her case, maybe she doesn't need love, but she does not need that kind of physical intimacy. We learn that body and mind are not two separate entities. What happened in the body will have an effect on the mind and vice versa. The oneness of body and mind is what we learn from the Buddha also. Mind rely on the body to manifest and body remind I rely on mind not to be alive, to be possible. And when you love someone, you have to respect him or her, not only her mind, but also her body. You respect your own body, and you respect his body, because your body is you, is your mind. His mind and his body are connected. So true love should have the nature of reverence, respect. In the Asian tradition, you have to treat your spouse with respect. Like a guest, you treat your spouse as a guest. Not only before marriage, but after marriage, you have to be respectful of him, or have to be respectful of her. And in order to respect her, you have to respect yourself first. And reverence should be the nature of our love. Parents in my country are always very proud to introduce their child to a guest. They will ask the child to come and bow to the guest to see, for the guest to see how beautiful the child is. And they usually have a little conversation, like, "Do you love your father, your mother?" And the child said, "Yes, I love my father. I love my mother." The child is learning to speak. And the next question: "Where do you put your love?" And the child has been instructed before. "My love, I put it on my head. Not in my heart, but on my head." In the upper mallet, if you notice, when the monk is about to put on his sangati, a saffron robe, for a ceremony, he's holding his sangati with reverence. It's like when he handles a scripture, because that is the Dharma you have to respect. So if you approach the monk and you bow to him, he will find a place to put the sangati on before he bow back to you. And if he does not find any decent place to put his scripture or his sangati, he will put on his head. You have noticed that, because this is a very noble place to put the Bible, or the sutra, or the sangati. It is like the altar. You worship your ancestors with your head. And that is a tradition. That is why in the Vietnamese manner, you should not touch the head of another person if you don't know him or her very well, because that is an offense. This is one of the sacred places of the body. Because that person feels that the head is the altar to worship ancestors and the Buddha. So you have to treat that part of his or her body as an altar. Therefore, you can shake hand, you can pat on his shoulder, but not touch that. That's a problem of culture. And then there are other parts of the body that are also secret, sacred, that you should not touch. If you touch, you don't feel respect for him or for her. It's like in the imperial city, there is the purple city where the family of the king live. And you are not supposed to wander and to penetrate in that area. And if you do, they will arrest you and cut off your head. If you penetrate into the compound of the purple city. So in a person's body, there are areas that are forbidden to touch. Whether you are a man or a woman, there are areas to be respected. And if you don't show respect, if you touch that part of the body, you are like penetrating into the purple city, and people will cut your head off. And not only people in Asia feel that way, but people in Europe and America feel that way also. When a child is sexually abused, he suffers very deeply. Someone has violated the purple, her purple city, and she was not strong enough, she did not have courage to protect herself or himself. And there are children who have been abused at the age of 8, 9, 10. And they suffer very deeply. And they blame their parents for not having protected them. And their relationship with their parents become difficult. And if their relationship with their parents are difficult, the relationship with their friends and their future lovers will be also very difficult. The wounds are always there. Children, sexual abuse of children is overwhelming. They said that in America, from 5 to 15% of the boys, little boys, are abused sexually. And from 15 to 35% of little girls are abused sexually. That's a lot. And when a child is abused like that, she or he will suffer all her life of many things because they don't respect her body. And in school and in family, we don't teach them to respect themselves, to respect their own body, and to respect the body of the other person. In monastic life, we teach the novices fine manners. We have the precepts, but we also have fine manners. In China, lay. In Confucianism, lay means fine manners, the etiquette, the way to behave. We need. Is five manners in monastic life. You have the precept, but you have also five manners. As a novice, you have to learn fine manners. Parents might be too busy. And they allow the opportunities for their children to be abused sexually, even by people in the family or out of the family. And that is why fine manners have to be practiced in school and in families. Sometimes a child is abused by teachers, by school bus drivers. Sometimes a child is abused by their own father or mother, uncle, big brothers. And we are so busy, we don't have the time to take care, to be the brother, the sister in the Dharma for them. And if that lady who lived 2 weeks in the upper hamlet feels safe because the brothers in the upper hamlet practice fine manners, they are equipped with the practice of the precepts and fine manners, that is why they create a safe environment. So if you are legislators, if you are politicians, if you are parents or teachers, if you are educators, please think about it. We can learn from the teaching of the Buddha to organize our life in the family, in the school, in society, in such a way that it can be protected and our child will be always protected. Even if you have already been ordained fully as a monk, when you go out, you have to go with a second body. In Plum Village, we have the system, the second body system. When a nun goes out, she is always accompanied by another nun or a laywoman practitioner. She cannot go out alone. That is the practice of the precepts and the fine manners. And that is one thing I would like we should remember, and maybe together we can reorganize our life so that the environment will be safe for all of us and for our children. We have said in the beginning that sensual pleasures, sexual desire is not love. But our society is organized in such a way that sensual pleasure become the most important thing. They want to sell their products. And they do advertisement. They water the seed of craving in you. They want you to consume so that you will have a sensual pleasure. But sensual pleasures can destroy you. What we need deeply is understanding, mutual understanding, trust, love, emotional intimacy, spiritual intimacy. But we don't have the opportunity to meet that kind of deep need in us. Many young people in our society want to have cosmetic surgery in order to meet with the standard of beauty. There are women fashion magazines that tell us in order to succeed, you have to look like this and to use this kind of product. If you want to be a successful woman, you have to look like this. And that is why many young people suffer very much, because they cannot accept their body. They want their body to be otherwise, because the people are expected another kind of body. And that is why they want to have a surgery in order to transform their body. When you do not accept your body as it is, you are not your true home. Your body is a kind of flower. Every man, every child is born in the garden of humanity as a flower. And flowers differ from each other. Breathing in, I see myself as a flower. Breathing out, I feel fresh. Everyone is a flower in the beginning. And she has to accept herself as a flower, different from other kind of flowers. And if she shall accept her body, and then she has a chance to have to see her body as home. If you don't accept your body, you cannot have a home. If you cannot accept your mind, you cannot be a home to yourself. And there are many young people who do not accept their body, who do not accept who they are. They want to be someone else. And how can you be home for yourself? And how can you be home for the other person? And that is why in the educational circle, we have to tell the people they are already beautiful as they are. They don't have to be another person. They has a calligraphy. Be beautiful, be yourself. Be beautiful, be yourself. And that is very important practice. You have to accept yourself as you are. And when you practice building a home in yourself, you become more and more beautiful. You have peace. You have warmth. You have joy. You feel wonderful within yourself. And people will recognize the beauty of your flower because you are born as a flower in the garden of humanity. The monks, the nuns, when they receive the bhikshu or the bhikshunu precepts, they want to live a holy life. If you see that a monk is beautiful because he has brought in the spiritual element in his life. If you see a beautiful nun, it is because she has brought in a spirituality element within her life. And spirituality here means mindfulness, concentration and insight. The five mindfulness trainings are recommended for everyone, not only for monastics but also for lay people. And mindfulness is the kind of energy that can help you to go home to yourself, to be in the here and the now, so that you know what to do and what not to do in order to preserve yourself, in order to build your true home, in order to transform your own afflictions and to be the home for other people. And the five mindfulness trainings are the very concrete way of practicing mindfulness. And they make you holy. People speak of holiness, but people do not know exactly what it means to be holy. In Buddhist tradition, holiness is made of mindfulness. And mindfulness brings within itself the energy of concentration and insight. Mindfulness, concentration and insight make you holy. So holiness is possible with monks and nuns, but also with lay people who practice the precepts. Holiness does not exist only with celibacy. Because there are those who are celibate but who are not holy. Because they don't have enough mindfulness, concentration, and insight. There are those who live a conjugal life, but if they have mindfulness and concentration and insight, they have the element of holiness in them. If the monks observe celibacy, not to have a sexual relationship, that does not mean that sexual relationship is cannot be holy, but because as a monk, you have to behave like that. Celibacy. It's like an astronaut going up to the sky. You should not be pregnant. If you are pregnant, you cannot be an astronaut. It's not because to be pregnant is something bad. The human body can be something very beautiful. I have said before that the human body is a real flower. We have seen many beautiful things around us. A tree can be very beautiful. A flower can be very beautiful. The snow, the river, the willow, many beautiful things. A bird, a swan, a horse. A deer can be very beautiful. And the human body is one of the most beautiful things that we can see. But we have to learn how to treat beauty. We are free to contemplate the beauty, but we should not try to we should not behave in such a way that we can destroy the beauty. Sexual intimacy can be a beautiful thing if there is mindfulness, concentration, insight, mutual understanding and love. Otherwise, it will be very destructive. In the sutra, they describe the moment when Queen Mahamaya was pregnant of the Buddha. In her dream, she saw a white elephant, very gentle. Mahamaya dreamt of a white elephant. And her trunk was holding a lotus flower. The elephant touched her with the lotus flower and entered into her very, very softly. And she was pregnant of Siddhartha. That is the way they describe a relationship, sexual relationship in the palace before Siddhartha was conceived. Gentleness, beauty. But as we have learned from the beginning, sexual intimacy should not occur before there is communion, understanding, the sharing of in the emotional and spiritual level. And then the physical, the sexual intimacy can become also holy. To practice Buddhism as a monk is always easier than to practice as a lay person. In the Vietnamese saying, thứ nhất là tu tại gia, thứ nhì tu chờ, thứ ba tu chùa. To practice as a monk is easiest. To practice as a lay person is much more difficult. So, to refrain from all sexual activities altogether is much easier than to have a sexual relationship. Because to have sexual relationship in the context of mutual understanding and love, you need a lot of practice. Otherwise, you create suffering for him, for you, for her. Parallax asked me to speak about fidelity. In Buddhism, we speak of the four. We have the teaching of the four elements of true love. The Brahma Vihara, the four Brahma Viharas. Love without frontiers. There is a journalist who had four lovers at the same time in France. One in Bordeaux, one in Lyon, one in Marseille, and so on. And that one who lived in Paris, she loved him very much. And he told her very frankly that he had four lovers, and she is only one of them. And that lady truly loved him. But one day, before he wanted to sleep with her, she said, "Now, let's sit together and breathe and look deeply to see what we really need. Darling, I really need you. I need you to be by my side, to understand me, to take care of me, to help me when I have difficulties. That's what I need. And when you are not there in that way, well, I suffer." And several sessions of sitting like that help him to understand that this is not love. This is only desire. And because she's a practitioner, she helped him to understand. And finally, he decided to marry her and release the other three people. There's a woman doctor in Switzerland. She came to practice in Plum Village. She has suffered several times out of relationship. She could not say no to a man when he asked for sexual relationship. Since the time she was young, every time she was asked to have a sexual relationship with a man, she had to say yes, even she did not feel ready. Because she's afraid. Many teenagers in our time feel that way. They don't like it. They don't want it. They don't feel ready for it. But they do not dare to say no. because they are afraid to be looked upon as weird, as strange. That as abnormal. Many young people are afraid of it, but they did not dare to say no. They don't want to be rejected. They want to be accepted. And that is a psychological fact that parents and teachers have to be aware of. We have to tell our children, our students, the young people, that they should learn to say no when they are not ready, when they are afraid. Otherwise, they will destroy their body and their mind. And in our time, it's very difficult for them to say no. I found it so hard to say no when inside of me I knew I was not ready. I was afraid that I would be rejected and unloved, unaccepted. I think many young women find it hard to say no to having a sexual relationship because it is so expected and so the norm of relationships in this area. As I look back, I really did not know how to say no skillfully to protect myself and to protect the other person. And I was not able to talk to my mommy or my aunt either. I was so afraid. So please listen to the young people. Be compassionate. Help them. We have to find out a skillful way to say no. That lady doctor who came from Switzerland, she has learned in privilege the way to say no. She has suffered so many times and she did not want to suffer anymore. And in her last relationship, she was able to say no. She said, I need you, my beloved. We need to understand each other. I need your presence. I need someone to help me when I have difficulties, to understand me. And she spent 1 year and 1 year and a half with him without having any relationship. She was skillful enough to say no. And when we went to her country for a Dhamma talk, she very proudly introduced her husband to us. That person accepted finally to marry her. And the relationship was wonderful, very successful, because she was able to say no and to help him and build that kind of relationship. That is lasting. The first element of true love is maitri, which is to offer happiness. Maitri. You have to be the sunshine for him, for her. You have to be the fireplace for him or for her. You have to be a home for him or for her. And that is what you offer. But you cannot offer that until you have it. So build a home inside. Accept yourself. Be beautiful. Be yourself. Heal yourself. Love yourself. Learn how to produce moments of joy and happiness for your own nourishment. Practicing the Dharma in such a way that you can create moments of happiness and joy for yourself. And then you have something to offer him or her. The second is Karuna. Karuna is the capacity to understand the suffering in yourself and then in the other person. If you understand his or her own suffering, you can help him or her understand his suffering. Because the understanding of suffering brings about compassion and relief. So you have the energy of Karuna, the power to help transform him or her. That is the second aspect of true love. With Maitri, you can offer you sunshine, warmth, home. With Karuna, you can transform your own suffering and help transform his or her own suffering. And this is the kind of energies that we can generate by practicing mindfulness. And mudita, joy. If you know how to generate joy that nourish you and nourish him or her. And lastly, upeksha. Upeksha means equanimity, non-discrimination. In a deep relationship, there is no longer any frontier between you and him or her. You are him, you are her. It's like in a spiritual relationship. You are the Buddha. The Buddha is you. You are in the Buddha, and the Buddha is in you. So your own suffering is his own suffering. Your understanding of your own suffering help him to suffer less. Suffering and happiness are no longer individual matters. What happened to him happened to you. What happened to you happened to her. There's no longer any discrimination. Upeksha is inclusiveness. Non-duality, non-discrimination. And these are four qualities that you can practice in true love. And that is very nourishing, very healing. If your love is made with these four elements, your love is healing, is transforming. Your love has the element of holiness in it. And that is the Holy Spirit. Because it is made of mindfulness, concentration, and insight. And in that case, the physical intimacy, I say sexual intimacy, becomes something very beautiful, very consolidating. There are times when you sit and you look at your child, look at the child is sleeping, and when the child sleeps, she or he will reveal the tenderness, the suffering, the hope, just contemplating a child sleeping. And observe your feeling. Understanding and compassion will arise in you, and you will know how to take care of the child, to make him or her happy. Your partner also. You should have a chance to observe her, observe him when he sleeps. Look deeply and see some tenderness revealed during that, the suffering, the hope, the despair that can be expressed during the time of sleeping. Sit there for 15 minutes, maybe half an hour, and just look. And in you there will be understanding, compassion arising, and you would know how to handle, to help your partner. And when your partner wants to have a sexual relationship, you might like to invite him or her to sit with you for 15 minutes quietly to see whether this is something that you really want or he really wants. A deep communion or just to satisfy some desire. And sitting like that quietly and breathing in and out for 15 minutes is very beautiful. You and him, you and her. And you might offer him your hand. He will be holding your hand for a few minutes. And maybe after that you feel that is enough. Because sexual relationship can be something very holy also. The birth of Siddhartha is very welcome. And we need people like Siddhartha in order to show us the way. The birth of a flower. And so we have to distinguish between sexual desire and true love. And true love. In Buddhism, we also have the teaching of the four nutriments. The Buddha was 35 when he got enlightenment, still very young. And of course, at the age of 35, we still have sexual energies. We have many young monks and nuns in Plum Village. they do have sexual energies like everyone else. And we learn how to handle the sexual energies in us. You know, in the tradition, monks, they only eat once a day at lunch, at noontime. And if they live in the cold countries, they will eat lightly in the evening. That is one way to handle the energy within themselves. They practice chopping the wood, carrying the water, cooking, do everything. Practice sitting meditation, walking meditation. They use the energy in order to do these things. They organize retreats. They take care of their brothers and sisters. They help take care of their friends who come from far away to practice. And they are spending their energy in such a way so the sexual energy is no longer a big problem. The same thing is true with the Buddha. He was interested in many things, helping people, educating, building a sangha, educating monks and nuns and lay people. And with that amount of understanding and compassion, he could handle his sexual energy very easily. You have a deep aspiration. Bodhicitta, you have a big aspiration, deep aspiration. You want to be and to do things that can relieve, help relieve the suffering of this world. And you find happiness and contentment trying to realize that kind of aspiration. That is why for a practitioner, a strong aspiration is very important. And if you have that aspiration, and if you are able to realize your aspiration, well, the sexual energy in you is no longer a big problem. And that is why nguyện, aspiration, is very important. The Bodhisattva Shitigagpa is someone that incarnates a strong aspiration. Where there is, wherever there is suffering, I vow to go there and help. And I feel fulfillment, contentment, happiness, helping people. That is why sexual energy is no longer a big problem. I can handle easily. That is true with the Buddha and practitioners who have a strong, a deep aspiration. So the first source of energy is edible food. We have to learn to eat in such a way that can create a balance. We have to learn how to eat with moderation. We only need that amount of energy and not more. So mindful eating is the practice. Don't go to the market when you are hungry. You have the tendency to buy more than you need. Don't eat beside your meals. Do like the brothers in Abraham. And we can organize our family in such a way, our community in such a way. The art of eating, the art of handling edible food. Because there are those of us who feel lonely, and in order to forget their loneliness, they go to the kitchen. They open the refrigerator and they take things to eat. That's not good. Edible food is the first nutriment. And we have to learn to eat in such a way that preserve compassion in us. We have to eat in such a way to prevent illness, to make our body healthy, and not to destroy this body that has been transmitted to us by our ancestors. And this is the practice of mindfulness, called mindfulness of eating. And we have the 5 contemplations for you to practice before eating and during the time of eating. And secondly, sensory impression. This kind of nutriment we do not consume by the way of the mouth. We consume with our eyes, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. When we read a magazine, we consume. When we watch a television program, we consume. And what we consume may have an effect on our body and our mind. There are many toxic products that they sell, like craving, like anger, like fear, because we want to have a strong emotion. That is why they can sell us many things. And the market is full of these items. And that is why we have to consume with mindfulness. We should choose the kind of television programs that are not toxic for us, for our children. They should not be craving violence, fear, anger. Because if we consume these things, we destroy ourselves inside. We cannot be the home for ourselves and for the other person. When I was in India, I was invited by the Times of India to be guest editor on the day of the anniversary of Mahatma Gandhi. I was sitting with other editors, and suddenly one person showed a piece of news that just came. There was a bomb attack, many people died. And one of the editors said, "Thầy, what we should do in a day like this when we receive so many bad news? As a journalist, how should we react?" I remember that I practiced mindful breathing 3 times deeply before I answer. I said, "Gentlemen, you have to report the truth on your newspaper. You have to tell the truth. You cannot hide the truth about violence, anger, and fear. But you have to report in such a way that will not water the seed of anger, fear, despair in people. In order to do that, you have to be peaceful. You have to look deeply to understand why such attack happened. What kind of emotion that the terrorist had why they are preparing the attack with that book. So you have to understand. And you should have compassion within yourself. And understanding and compassion help you to write a report that can tell the truth in such a way that will not water the seed of anger and fear and despair in the mind of your readers. And that is our practice, our spiritual practice. And everyone appreciated that that answer. So if you are a journalist, you write articles in such a way, you report on events that happen in the world in such a way that help, that promote understanding and compassion in the mind of people, even if they are learning what is happening in the world. And if not, we will empoison people and make this world into a place not safe for us and safe for our children. So when we consume magazines, news, television, when we consume music and other things in order to forget our suffering inside, we are making the situation inside of us more and more difficult. We are destroying the little home inside that is not home building. So consume radio, television, books, even conversation in such a way that you will not bring in toxins. Because you need a home inside for yourself and for him or for her. So mindful consumption of sensory impressions is very important. What does not help to build a home, you refuse to consume. Consume only what can be helpful in building a home inside of you. And the third source of nutriment is volition. Your desire, your hope, your aspiration. This is the energy that keeps you alive. You want to be someone. You want to do something with your life. And if you are motivated by compassion, by love, by true love, you have a good source of energy, volition. But if your volition, your desire is to punish, to kill, to destroy, that is not good nutriment. So every one of us should look deeply to see what is the deepest aspiration of our life. To run after fame, wealth, sex, good food, power, is not good volitions. Because so many people destroy their body and their mind running after these objects of craving. So we should have the kind of wholesome volition. We should have the kind of deep aspiration that push us into being someone, doing something that can help society, the planet, relieve the suffering of the world. And if you have that element of nutriment in you, you are a true home for yourself. You are a true home for him or for her. So give rise to the mind of love in you, the mind of love, a strong aspiration for peace, compassion, understanding. I vow to develop understanding and compassion in me with my practice, so that I can become an instrument of peace and love to help society and the world. That is the kind of volition that we need. And those of us who have that kind of volition, we are strong. We are able to confront any kind of obstacles and difficulties. If we have that kind of volition in us, bodhicitta, the mind of love, the deepest aspiration. And finally, the fourth source of nutriment is consciousness. Consciousness here is the collective feeling, the collective thinking. Because our individual consciousness is influenced by the collective consciousness. If we live in a place where people only think of sensual pleasure, and then we'll be carried away by that desire also. You are not like that, but if you put yourself into that environment, you become one of them. So if you live in a place where there is a lot of hate, a lot of violence, you know that your child will consume the collective energy of hate and violence. So realizing that you are not in a good environment, where the collective consciousness is negative, is destructive, you have to right away pull yourself out of that environment for your sake, for your children's sake. Get out of that environment right away, not to continue to consume that kind of collective feeling, collective emotion of anger, of fear, of despair. If you want to help, you go back after you get the strength. And with the Sangha, you can go back to help. But now, to continue in that environment is suicidal. So if you realize that the environment is toxic, you have to stop right away. Because collective consciousness is destructive. Come to a place like Plumbish, where there is no collective hate, collective violence, and there is enough brotherhood and sisterhood for our children to use as nutriments. And give rise to the strong aspiration to build a place like that for our own refuge and for the refuge of our other friends of us. And that is provide ourselves with the fourth kind of nutriment. In a relationship where you share with your partner the same kind of aspiration, and then you become one, and you are become an instrument of love and peace, and whatever you do together, because you are a sangha of two people, a sangha of three people, of four people, of 100 people, like in Upper Hamlet. We do everything together. We have the same concern. We have the same desire. We have the same future. There's no place, no more place for jealousy. Because we are both, we are all faithful to the same aspiration. And whatever the other person does, you do it with him or her. You share everything. That is the spirit of upeksha. So that makes fidelity possible. And you still have your freedom. And she still have her freedom intact. Love is not a kind of prison. Love, true love, gives us a lot of space. And whether whatever you enjoy, the other person will enjoy. And what concerns you, the other person feel concern also. Maybe you have a few questions. Because I can continue like this for a long time. Sao sư cô nói sao? So we can stop now? Okay. So let us breathe together as a sangha with a bell.